It is Your Money. I'm Susie Jones, your host, along with Bruce Helmer, the founder of Wealth Enhancement Group and financial advisor, and Senior Vice President Peg Webb and financial advisor. Hello to both of you. It's going to be a great hour because it's Ask Bruce and Peg Anything.
Like, good morning, what? Susie. Good morning, Bruce.
Hi, Susie Jones. Hi, Peg Webb.
So open lines, huh?
Open lines, any and all financial questions are fair game. There's a good chance I won't know the answer, but Peg will. And if neither one of us know and you stump us, we'll figure it out eventually. Before we open up the line, Susie, and get listeners involved, the one thing I did want to mention, some people are concerned, you know, the government is shut down right now, mm-hmm. and a lot of people are concerned about what is that going to do to the economy, what's that going to do to their 401k, to the stock market. I went back and I checked a little bit, and I actually didn't know this, and I was surprised, but the government since 1976 has actually had over 20 shutdowns. Now, they've always been short-lived, mm-hmm. so they haven't been hugely impactful. We don't know how long this one is going to last. The longest one actually happened under President Trump's first term. From December of 18 to January of 19, the government was shut down for 35 days. That's the longest one. So you think the longest one would be bad news for the economy, but actually the stock market, as measured by the S&P 500, over that 35-day period of time was actually, for some reason, and Peg, I don't have an explanation for this, the stock market was up over 10%, and then the 12 months after the shutdown ended, the S&P was up, you know, over 25%. So government shutdowns, for whatever reason, and it seems contrary to most people's thinking, has not negatively impacted the stock market. So, Peg, I don't know. Are you getting questions? Are you concerned? Or what are you hearing? Or what would you add?
Well, I think it's probably real confusing to people because the retail sales is kind of through the roof, right? They had 6% solid pace in September. That's huge. And now, you know, they're thinking about, should we cut the rates more? And then another huge part of the economy is AI and all the investment that's going into equipment and intellectual property. And I mean, regardless if the government is shut down, I think people know that it's just a matter of time. They need to negotiate, and maybe it's a little difficult right now because, you know, the one side would love to get some change that they didn't get with our president in right now. So the economy is still soaring, and you can see that this week we actually gained in the markets another percent, which, you know, now the S&P 500 is still up 14.2% year to date. So I don't see any concern right now. I mean, if this goes on for a couple weeks, then I think people will say, ooh, when is this going to stop, Bruce?
Yeah, no, I agree. Susie, we, again, open lines. We'll take as many questions today as we can fit in. Peg and I have a couple things from previous weeks we can go to if we need to, but we'll get listeners involved ASAP.
All right, let's do it. 651-461-9226. 651-461-9226. Why don't we take that first one as we continue to get questions from our listeners? Actually, we have this one right here. What is the Russell 2000 and why don't we hear more about it? That's a listener just texted that in.
Oh, what a good question. So, Peg, everybody knows the S&P 500, everybody knows the Dow 30, but there's a lot of different indices that we look at. The Russell 2000 is one of a number of others, Peg.
Yeah, the Russell 2000 is, it's all kind of small companies, and you're right, it doesn't get a whole lot of press, but it is, there's probably about 2,000 stocks within the Russell, and I'm just looking here now, it actually started in 1984. You know, in our portfolios, I mean, we definitely have small companies in the portfolio. Like a lot of times we just talk about the S&P 500, right? That's the largest companies, and there's 500, you know, companies in that. But small stocks can actually have their day in the sun as well. And so, but we don't hear a lot about them, but we certainly at Wealth Enhancement Group participate in small companies as well.
Yeah, our portfolios are almost always diversified. We do have some portfolios that can be just large cap or even just large cap domestic, but generally speaking, we believe in diversification. And Peg, I've actually been talking about this on my fall seminar series. You know, the last couple of years, large cap stocks have been the best performing asset class. And on occasion, I will get a client that will say, look, why do you guys have all this money in small cap stocks and foreign stocks? And why are you in all these other asset classes? I would have done better if you had just put all my money in the large cap stocks. But that's not always true. A lot of years, large cap stocks are not the best performing asset class, and nobody knows in any given year going into it what the best performing asset class will be. So diversification definitely smooths out the ride, definitely will reduce risk. It may or may not enhance returns, but again, I want to remind people, this is one of the things I'm talking about at the fall seminar, when we help clients invest money, Peg, I think most people, and Susie and listeners, I think if you ask most people, what's your goal on your investment, without thinking about it, they'd probably say the first thing that would come to their mind would be, I want to get the highest return I can. But I will tell everybody, that's generally not my goal. My goal for my client is to get the rate of return that they need to achieve their goals and objectives. And that's going to be different for everybody. We help them figure out, when do you want to retire? What does your lifestyle look like at retirement? How much is it going to cost for you to live the way you want to live? Then we factor in inflation and some other variables that we don't know for sure what they will be, but we can make reasonable assumptions based on history. And we can kind of figure out what is the rate of return you need to achieve to hit those goals. I want to create a portfolio for them that will achieve that rate of return, but I want to do it with the least amount of risk possible. So thus diversification and multiple asset classes. So yeah, to the texter's question, Susie, the Russell 2000 is just another index that we look at. And as Peg said, they're mostly little companies as opposed to the Dow and the S&P that are big companies.
All right.
Well, and I mentioned AI, and you know, a lot of these small companies are tech companies, so it kind of makes sense that they're riding high as well. Susie.
All right. 651-461-9226. Person writes, if I sign a monetary pledge for a church campaign when I die, are my heirs compelled to complete that pledge donation?
Oh, wow. That's an interesting question. So, I see this a lot, and it is not uncommon at all. So, let me give some context, and I'm not sure the answer. Maybe you are, but it's not uncommon to make a pledge and to do future gifting to your church or various charities. I know, you know, I've done some charitable giving, and when I talk to these charities, they're very adamant about future giving or future commitments or endowments and whatnot. Yes, they need money today immediately, but to givers that might be considering giving now, it's important to know that the charity, or in this case the church, is going to have legs or staying power so they can point to these future endowments and say, we have givers that have committed to do this in the future. But if somebody makes a commitment and they leave this world, I don't know how you would hold that person to the commitment, or if you go after the next generation. I would think that's, last week we talked about communicating to your kids. Maybe that's one of those things. You got to communicate and say, hey, when I die, I've committed to do this for this charity or for our church. Peg, I'm not sure.
Well, you can absolutely put that in your will. And name, you know, that you have this continuing, or maybe what you do is you Actually, you could. You could just define how, you know, as time goes on, how much you want to give to charities. Now, a lot of times we would say, well, don't put it in your will. Maybe you put it on an IRA that's taxable and it'll be taxable to the heirs. So you could also, some custodians don't like this and they're not going to like me saying this, but you could, you know, write on there if something happened to you, I'd like a direct, you know, deposit to go to my charity and list the information. So those are a couple of ideas how to get that charity contribution, you know, taken care of. I'm happy that you want to give to charities, and so many of our clients do give to charities, and they take up our opinion on, you know, if you are over 70 and a half, you can take money out of your IRA every year to give to charity, and then that income, if you will, disappears on your income tax. And so I think that's a good idea to check into. Maybe you could make a list or write it down in your contract, if you will, your will or your trust, that needs to continue.
Yeah, and to the texter's question, you know, mom and dad make this commitment, and let's say they pass away and the kids don't want to honor it. If they haven't taken legal steps, if it's not in a will or if it's not in a beneficiary designation, and if it's, you know, I don't know how enforceable something is if the kids don't want to, but I would assume, and that's probably why we've never had, I never remember having this question before, it's probably because the kids would be consistent with mom and dad's wishes, and they wouldn't want to not honor the commitment that mom and dad made. But if they didn't, I'm not sure how that would ultimately be resolved, if that's what the texter's asking. That's a tricky one. That's an interesting question. Susie?
All right, 651-461-9226. That is the line you can call if you have a question for Bruce or for Peg. Again, it is Ask Bruce or Peg and Peg anything that is on your mind financially. 651-461-9226. A texter wonders, what is the average age of wealth enhancement clients and the average portfolio size? I guess that's a fair question.
Yeah, that is fair. Peg, do you know?
No. The reason I wouldn't know, and I've known, you know, for many, many years, is that we've been acquiring practices nationally, all the way from Los Angeles to New York City.
Mm.
And so I have not witnessed the number of, or the average age or the average portfolio for a long time.
Bruce?
Okay. Well, the last I knew, and you're right, Peg, this is a couple of years old, so I'm not sure how accurate it still is, but the marketing team actually, you know, did an internal study. And the numbers I remember is that the average age client was like early 50s, and the average portfolio was like $450,000. But so I don't know how much that's changed, but I guess the message I would give to everybody is it really doesn't matter to us. You know, again, there are certain advisors at Wealth Enhancement that might have minimums to work with if you want, but as a company, we never want to turn anyone away that genuinely wants our help. So to me, how much money you have or don't have or how old you are doesn't really matter. If you're looking for help, you can always reach out and somebody at Wealth Enhancement will help you. But it's a fair question. It's an interesting question. But yeah, we've grown so fast, and I don't know how often we look at those internal numbers. So I just don't know. The number I just gave is still accurate, but that was accurate a couple years ago. But Peg, again, not to belabor the point, our growth, both in terms of organic growth, attracting new clients, retaining clients, but now acquiring practices around the country, a lot of people don't know this. Wealth Enhancement went over $100 billion in assets under management this year, and I think we're now one of the top five registered investment advisory firms in the country and probably the fastest growing.
All right, 651-461-9226. We have a call this morning from Dave in Murdoch, Minnesota. Not sure where that is. Good morning, Dave. Thanks for joining us. Where is Murdoch?
About 25 miles northwest of Wilmer.
Okay, very good. We'll go on. You're on with Bruce and Peg.
Yes, thank you. Enjoy your program. Never miss it. Can you explain the concept of upstream inheritance?
Hey, Dave, thanks for listening and thanks for calling in. And I do know where Murdoch is. I grew up in Olivia. So Kirk Hovind, Murdoch, Sunberg, KMS, we played in sports, and I know exactly where you are. That's my old stomping ground. And then I went to college in Morris, Minnesota. Peg, do you know what was that, Dave, upstreaming inheritance?
Yes, upstream inheritance. My understanding is it's where your what child or someone can actually give you inheritance, and I don't know anything really about it. I just had heard people talking about it.
Peg, are you familiar with that term?
No, I'm not. But since you were talking, I just put it in the Google search, and it's really an AI search these days, right? And so actually there is such a thing, and I have never in my entire decades here have talked about it or knew about it, but it seems like it is. It's often a child with highly appreciated assets, you know, leave those assets to an older family member, which is kind of interesting.
And also, you guys, just looking at it too, if an older person in your life needed money, could you gift it to them to help them live out a life if they haven't planned accordingly?
You know, that's kind of interesting, Susie, in that, you know what I have seen a lot is the child, like, buying a house or a townhome or something, and a lot of times it's because, let's say, sorry to say that, but it would be the father, the dad, you know, passed earlier, and women still statistically live longer than men.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen, you know, some of our clients go and purchase a home, or they're assisting them with the nursing home or just the living place. What do you call that? Not nursing home, but, you know, the
assisted living. I think that's
assisted
right.
Assisted living, where, you know, you go into phases with that. So
right.
That might, and I just haven't, you know, taken that term that you used of upstream, you know, kind of gifting, but that's what that would be then.
Interesting.
Yeah, Dave, it makes sense. So the name makes sense when you describe it. It's unusual, but not unheard of. And Peg, I agree with you. I've seen the same kind of circumstance, but it's just atypical because usually older people have more of the wealth than the younger people. But yeah, if you can flip it around and a younger person can help an aging parent or another relative, upstream inheritance. I never heard that term before. Hey, Peg, we got just a couple minutes left. Is there anything in our mailbag, a question that we had from previous weeks that you wanted to talk about today, and is now a good time to do it?
Yes. You know, so many people are wondering about this deduction, and it's called the SALT. That's your state and local tax deduction, and it's a huge change, and it's including 2025, is that you can deduct $40,000. And so what that's going to do is having more people itemize, because it used to be a $10,000 cap. Now, who's eligible for that is people who make under $500,000. And so you might be listening thinking, oh, well, how many people could that be? Well, a lot of these states like New York and Illinois with Chicago and California, they have a lot of high taxes. I could say Minnesota too. But so those people are anxious to be able to write more off on their itemized taxes. And there is kind of a phase out too between 500 and 600,000 that you could get a reduction, but you'll still get some deduction for doing the itemized. Now, a lot of people won't be able to itemize still because the standard deduction is still quite high. So I think people are going to look at it in 2025 when they do their taxes. Which way should I go? What's the best for me?
And again, Peg, just for clarity, our industry is so quick to develop acronyms for so many things. The SALT is a state and local taxes. And I think we first brought this up, you know, a couple weeks ago when we were talking about some of the things that the new tax law put in place when we had some clarity on it. And I think ever since we brought it up, and it was coming up before that, but it almost created more questions than answers, because ever since we talked about it, I'm getting a lot of questions on it. Anything else on that? Do you think that's good for now? We got I guess we're coming up to the end of the first segment, but anything else on salt that you can think of that people should know?
Well, we keep talking about state and local taxes, but it's also your property taxes, which can be huge, and then some vehicle taxes you can throw in there too. So it'll be interesting to see how many clients are going to itemize now instead of be standard.
It will be more than it was, but most people, I assume the majority, are still going to take the standard deduction. But I think it was like between 70 and 75%. That's probably going to come down a little because of this. Some people will now be able to itemize that weren't before, but it's probably a small number.
All right, 651-461-9226. If you have a question, you can call that number or you can text your question. It is Ask Bruce and Peg Anything, which is a rare opportunity, a great opportunity. If you have a question for Bruce or Peg, they'll get to as many of your questions after this short break. It is Your Money. Bruce Helmer, Peg Webb, back right after this. And we are back for the second half of Your Money. Bruce Helmer, the founder of Wealth Enhancement Group and financial advisor, and Peg Webb, senior vice president and financial advisor, taking your questions. It is Ask Bruce and Peg Anything, 651-461-9226, 651-461-9226. You can call and ask your question on the air, or you can text it to Bruce and Peg. Bruce, I'll let you take it away before we get to some more questions,
if that's okay. Thank you, Susie Jones. Really quickly, Peg, I know you wanted to talk about, and I'm getting questions on this too, and it was one of the questions that we had in our mailbags, and it's very current, about the federal government talking about phasing out paper checks. Where's that at? What does that mean to people? Originally, I think they were talking about they wouldn't even let you write a check to pay your taxes anymore. You had to wire money. Where's all that at? Because I think for some people, that idea is kind of new age and intimidating.
Yeah, I don't know what percentage of people really still take a paper check, but my sense is, and this is just from hearing about this for so long because they had this date coming, is to try to control fraud when it comes to Social Security. So they're not necessarily doing it because they want everybody to, you know, have a bank account and get the Social Security money directly deposited. They believe that's safer than, you know, these checks that would go in the mail and they were not getting to the person that was supposed to get them, or it was just a fraudulent, you know, name. People, it kind of came up with the campaign with Trump, and that there's just so much money going out that's lost. So how do you, if you're relying on a paper check, you know, you should still call the federal government because they may have a reason that they'll still let you take the paper. I don't know how convincing you can be, but you can enroll online, which is actually godirect.gov. And I'm sure the people listening today, you've been hearing about it. If you're one of those people that were getting a paper check, if you haven't taken any action, you're probably not going to get a check. So you have to go and take care of getting that done. And so enrolling and making sure you open a bank account so that your money will, I think that's motivating, right, for them. You have to have a bank account. So now it's time to go get one. And that's kind of a reason that people are wanting to do that right now because they need that money, Bruce.
Yeah, and again, it's impactful. It's where we've been, the direction we've been going for a long time with not just technology, but like you said, Peg, for safety and protect yourself from identity theft. But yeah, it impacts your tax refunds. It impacts veterans benefits, your Social Security check. And it's a two-way street, right? The government doesn't want to issue checks anymore, and they don't want you to send them checks anymore either. So, again, I think they can still make some allowances, but that is where we're headed, and everybody's going to kind of need to get on board with that reality. And, again, ultimately, it's for your own good. Susie?
All right, 651-461-9226. A texter asks you both, what should a 30-something person do to start investing somewhere that will make more than a high interest savings, but not an IRA because I may need to make withdrawals? Would use dollar cost averaging and electronically transfer money every month to the account.
Wow, Susie, that's such a good question because it's really several questions all in one text message. There's a lot of different roads we can go down on this one, Peg, and they're all good roads. It's a great question.
Well, here's what I would do, and I think this is probably the least thing that people think about. And the texter mentioned IRA. Well, there's this IRA that's called a Roth, right? A Roth. And you can put money in an IRA, provided that you're under a certain amount income-wise. And if you do, then the principal that you put in, because you're not getting a tax deduction for putting that money in a Roth IRA, believe it or not, you can take that principal out without any tax penalty or anything because you didn't pay tax. You know, you're putting in after-tax money. Now, the growth on a Roth IRA, that will grow, and you can't immediately take that out. There's a timeline that you have to follow. So this is what I tell young people. Why not? What if you don't need the money? Then you would be in this Roth IRA that's tax-free, growing tax-free. That's my best solution. And then when you talk about dollar-cost averaging, I'm actually a big dollar-cost averager. I have always been. One of the reasons I've been forward on that is because if you wait for a client to say, oh, today's the day that I want to put the money in, usually it's too late, right? And if the market's down, guess what? The client doesn't want to put it in because it's just such an emotional roller coaster. So dollar cost averaging is a great way of just getting money in and kind of hiding it from yourself because you could take money from your checking and just automatically every single month transfer it to a custodian. So that's my two cents on both of those things. What would you do? And then also, how would you dollar cost average?
Hey, Peg, really quickly for listeners that might not know, explain what dollar cost averaging means.
Yeah, so let's say you have $1,000 and you want to put it into the stock market. And normally you would do this with the stock market. And you would just say, okay, over the next 12 months, I'm going to take 1/12 of that and move it into my mutual fund or the stock that you want to purchase. So instead of taking the $1,000 and putting it in on one day, you're going to average that out over the next 12 months. The last thing I'll say about that, though, is if there's a huge dip in the market, you know, you can actually accelerate that dollar cost average because now you're thinking, oh, now the market's on sale. I could take the 6 months that I still have left on my dollar cost averaging and dump it into the market at that time.
I love everything you just said. The only thing I'm going to also add to that is, so I love that the texter, it sounds like, is in their 30s and they're thinking of this because too many 20-something and 30-something-year-olds are not doing this. And the sooner you start, the bigger, better your results are going to be. Doing something systematically as soon as you can is the key to success. Starting early, even if it doesn't seem like a lot of money now, you do that over a long period of time, and it becomes a lot of money. But the other thing I wanted to add is they talked about where do you put it and get something that's a higher return than an interest-bearing account. And Peg alluded to this, based on time horizon, and that's a key factor here, you're probably talking about investing in stocks. If your time horizon is short, if this is money that you're going to need in a year or two for a down payment for a house or to help pay for a wedding or something, then you don't want to put it in an IRA or a Roth IRA, probably. You probably just want a regular account. And you probably don't want to put it in the stock market, because even though historically, long-term, stocks have given investors their best returns, in the short term, it can be volatile. So time horizon is key, but I heard the question the same way you did, Peg. They're probably thinking long-term. That means a Roth IRA is a great idea, and putting that money in the market is a great idea. Because remember, the Roth IRA is not an investment. I still get questions, Peg, like, well, what's wealth enhancement paying on their Roth IRAs? Well, it depends. The Roth IRA is a tool. It's a strategy. And I can put stocks in it. I can put bonds in it. I can put funds in it. I can put a money market in it. I can put real estate, gold and silver, and precious metals. The Roth is not the investment. It's the strategy. So I like the strategy for the texture of Roth. And in terms of the investment, I agree with you, Peg, stock market. Susie?
651-461-9226. If you have a question for Bruce or Peg, Jim is calling today from St. Francis, Minnesota, with a question. Jim, go ahead. You're on the air with Bruce and Peg.
Well, thank you for taking my call. Excuse me. I'm confused. I have been forever on this cryptocurrency. Bitcoin, for example, is always expressed in dollars. It doesn't have its own denomination other than it's expressed in dollars. Currently, it's about $120,000 for a single Bitcoin. If I were to be stupid enough to accept a Bitcoin for the sale of my business or my rental property or my home, how would we be able to justify the change in the value? What would be the sale price if a Bitcoin went up 20% in 3 days? Any idea whatsoever? I'm confused on this, and it's to me, it's meaningless. The question is meaningless, but the answer would be valuable.
Hey, Jim, you're not alone in being confused.
Yeah.
I'm confused also, and I've talked to a lot of really smart people that presumably understand Bitcoin and cybercurrency and cryptocurrency better than I do, and I think sometimes they can't fully explain it or totally understand it. Peg, you wanna jump in? I got a couple things I can add to that, but I'll let you go first.
Yeah, I actually have not talked to clients or encouraged clients on cryptocurrency. I noticed that Schwab this week is, now just talking about maybe going all in. And so it's still so, but what can I say? It's just not, we don't know that currency is going to be the one, in the future. I know there's been a lot of talk with President Trump about, crypto and that kind of thing. And so we're starting to, I think the large institutions are starting to think, oh, this is going to happen, longer down the road. But other than that, Bruce, I don't have a lot to share.
Jim, the only thing I would add to what Peg said is, and again, I am not an expert on it either. But I agree with what Peg said. Bitcoin was the first one that almost everybody heard of. Since then, there's been a lot of others. And my kind of pat answer to people is, look, money is only money because we say it is, and it can change. What we call money can change. And just like we talked about earlier in the show, it used to be common that we wrote paper checks. That's going to go away. It's going away. And maybe paper money will go away. Maybe in the future, everybody will do their transactions with some sort of cyber or crypto money. But we're a long way from getting there. There's going to be, in addition to the questions that you had, there's other questions about what if this happens, what if this happens. There's going to ultimately have to be some settlement in terms of regulations. The government's going to have to get involved. Right now, it's the Wild West. There's no real regulations on any of this. So could Bitcoin or some sort of cryptocurrency be the currency of the future? Absolutely, that could happen. It's not going to be tomorrow or next week. It's going to be a longer process. Like I said, money's only money because we say it is. We used to be, before 1972, the government actually could not print more money than what they had in a vault in Fort Knox. It was backed by gold. but that hasn't been true since 1972. So money's money because we say it's money, and we can change what we say is money, and we might. But to Peg's key point, and here's the analogy I use, we don't know what the future crypto that we use might be. You know, just because Bitcoin is the one people know, and I think it was first, and it's the one most people have heard of, you know, there used to be a car called an Edsel. It was one of the first cars, and a lot of people bought stock in Edsel, and they lost their money. When the car was invented, we knew we weren't going to go back to the horse and buggy, but at one time there was over 130 car companies. How many are left standing today? So, Jim, I don't know the answer, but I would not sell a business right now and accept Bitcoin as the payment. I just absolutely would not do that.
Right. All right, 651-461-9226. If you have a question for Bruce or Peg, a caller called in and asked this question. I have more than one Roth IRA with my spouse in different institutions. I'm thinking of taking the older Roth out, but can I take all of them at once, or what would be the best strategy if otherwise?
So, Peg, it's not uncommon that people might have multiple accounts, in this case, multiple Roth IRAs. Talk a little bit about withdrawals or distributions, and also the possibility of doing some integrating and coordinating or consolidation.
Yeah, I think you have to be careful because of what I said before when the 30-year-old was asking about where should they put money, and I was going talking about Roth IRAs. Each contribution to a Roth IRA can have a time limit. So let's say you have $5,000 and you're going to put it into a Roth. And I talked about you want to take that $5,000 out one day because you can. This is like a really unique thing that you can take out that money that you put in and leave the growth in the Roth IRA. So a lot of times we don't recommend putting all the Roths together because it gets very confusing as to what your original principal was and what your growth is. So I'm not really quick to just consolidate all my Roths. The other thing you need to know is if you're doing a Roth through your 401k plan at work or have, that's a whole different set of rules, which is kind of interesting. So meshing all those Roths together can be kind of a nightmare, and you may lose out on some flexibility of being able to take that money out. I recently had a client that wanted to purchase a home and needed a little bit more money as a down payment. And that was the only resource we had. We were able to pull out some of that money from the Roth. Now, not people might say, why would you do that? It's growing tax-free. Well, in this circumstance, it just made sense because the market was so high, we were able to sell, take that original principal out, and then help them buy a house. Bruce?
Peg, that was such a smart answer, and you're absolutely right, and I hadn't thought of that. A lot of times we do consolidate with clients. We do try to make life easier, and if we can make three accounts, one account, and there's no detrimental impact, we might do that, but you just brought up a really good example about why it might not make sense in this case. The other thing I would add, though, is you mentioned, you know, being able to take out your principal or your contributions without any detrimental impact, but not your gains. But once, and this is important that everybody understand this, with a Roth, once you've got 5 years in the Roth or 59 and a half, whichever is later or whichever is longer, now the entire amount is available without any tax consequence. So let me give you some examples. You start a Roth when you're 50. At 55, you go, I've got 5 years in now. I can take tax-free withdrawals on all of my money. No, you can't. You're not 59 and a half yet. It's 5 years or 59 and a half, whichever is later. You start your Roth at 57. Now you're 59 and a half, and you think, I can take tax-free withdrawals of all of it. No, you can't. You don't have 5 years in yet. You got to wait until you're 62. But once you hit that 5 years or 59 and a half, then everything is available to you tax-free, and that's one of the many things that make Roth IRAs so potentially attractive. Susie?
651-461-9226. A texter wonders, are you seeing the impact on individual portfolios due to increased health care costs?
Oh, man. So, Peg, we talk about this all the time with clients. We've talked about it some on this program, but maybe not as often as we should. We've done seminars on it, but the increasing cost of health care or the cost of some sort of extended stay in some sort of assisted living or senior facility, that is probably for many people the biggest individual financial challenge they might face in their retirement years. Peg?
It's huge. The dollars that we're sending out for assisted living and, you know, home health care, it's just huge. And I was just shocked because this client, a lot of our clients, well, I can't say a lot, a percentage of our clients bought long-term care. And even with that long-term care, I just have to admit, we're sending, you know, $8,000 above what that, you know, from long-term care, because the basis for the start of the cost of this nursing home is it's not enough. The long-term care can't even provide, you know, the amount that they're requesting. So it is, it's huge. And I don't know if it's going to stop anytime soon, but I own long-term care. I know it's probably not going to cover everything, but yet my goal was to get my wealth to the next generation. So that was my motivation to do it. Could I pay for long-term care? Yes, I could, or assisted living, but I feel like I work so hard to build, you know, my wealth that I don't want to just give it to the nursing home one day. Bruce?
Yeah, really quickly, because I know we're almost out of time, Susie. I don't know that this is affecting, you know, returns on investment or what, but it does impact the advice that we give to people. So people that we might otherwise say, look, you're retired, let's get more conservative. Let's be more concerned about preservation than growth. Because of that potential cost, it's one of the reasons why we might have a client stay a little bit more aggressive than we otherwise would, because we need a higher return on investment to potentially help pay for that cost. So it influences all the planning that we do, whether it's investment management or retirement income choices. That's always going to be a consideration, and it's a huge deal, and it's a great text. It's maybe, Peg, a topic we can do a whole show on in the future. Susie, I know we're about out of time.
We are that, but thanks to everyone who called in. Thanks to everyone who texted in. Want to remind you that if you did not get your question answered, you can call 1-888-6-ADVICE. That's 1-888-6-ADVICE. Or email your questions to yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. Yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. You can call and get a free consultation. Make it a great week.